Iran slams the Biden administration for, quote, continuing to exert Trump's failed maximum pressure even amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The Yemeni army says its drones have successfully hit major targets at King Khalid Air Base in the Saudi province of Asir in response to the kingdom's aggression. Also in the headlines, an attack claimed by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group kills at least 20 people and wounds 30 others in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Thank you very much for joining us. Iran's foreign minister has once again urged Washington to abandon the sanctions against his country. He says ordinary Iranians are paying the price for the restrictions amid a raging coronavirus pandemic. Earlier in the news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests.
And now welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get an in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Iran's foreign minister has denounced Washington's persistence in its cruel and inhumane sanctions against his country amid a deadly coronavirus pandemic. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif urged the new U.S. administration to abandon the failed maximum pressure policy launched by former President Donald Trump. Zarif lamented that ordinary Iranians are paying the price for severe U.S. sanctions. He cited a little Iranian girl complaining that her disease has worsened due to restrictions hindering access to medicine. And Washington claims its sanctions exempt drugs and basic medical equipment, but crippling sanctions on Iran's banking and commercial sectors have impeded Iran's access to vital supplies. Bans are also believed to have affected Iran's battle against a COVID-19 outbreak. And joining us now for this news review is Margaret Flowers, co-director at PopularResistance.org out of Baltimore, Maryland, and Dr. Wilmer Leone, columnist and political scientist, joining us from Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Pleasure to have you both on. Margaret, we're going to start with you. Your thoughts on the humanity that the Iranian politicians have time and again alluded to behind these crippling sanctions from the U.S. towards Tehran.
Well, you know, it's really outrageous, and I think it's important to remind listeners that what the United States is doing to countries like Iran violates international law. These are unilateral coercive measures that are imposed on countries to try to get them to accede to the U.S.'s foreign policy interests. And it's really outrageous that the United States will say that these measures don't impact food and medicines and other basic necessities, because we have so much evidence that they do. That, you know, as you mentioned, or as, you know, Foreign Minister Zarif mentioned, you know, even if you have the money to pay for these and you try to purchase them, countries like Iran can't make the financial transactions, or even if they are able to make the financial transaction, often transporting the goods into the country becomes problematic. And so, you know, we in the United States have been trying to raise awareness of the fact that this is economic warfare, that it's just as deadly as military warfare. It violates international law, and it needs to end.
Thank you. And Dr. Wilmer Leone, pleasure to have you back on Press TV, especially during one of our news review programs. Doctor, your thoughts on, and Margaret just alluded to it, basically that a lot of people see it as economic warfare, and Mohammad Javad Zarif has even referred to it as an economic terrorism against the Iranian people. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think both Dr. Margaret Flowers, by the way, it's an honor to be on with her, and Mr. Zarif are absolutely correct. It's also important to understand that these types of sanctions, they don't work. If the objective of the sanction is to bring about regime change, what sanctions have a tendency to do is create a heightened sense of nationalism. So they wind up bringing the citizens closer to the very government that the United States is trying to depose. The sanctions historically, maybe in two or three instances in the course of recent history, and two or three might be being generous, sanctions just don't work. It is a form of economic warfare. And what is the United States trying to do by imposing such harsh sanctions on a country such as Iran? It makes absolutely no sense. And also, I think it tends to be more for domestic political consumption than anything else. It is a way for the administration to say to the American people, we are doing something, we are taking action, even though the action is really having greater impact on the civilians than it is on anyone else in the country. And in the instance of a pandemic such as this, where much needed medicine is much, much harder to come by, some might even be able to ask the question if this is another form of biological warfare.
Interesting. And Ms. Flowers, and that's a great point to Dr. Leon's point. Not only do these sanctions fail to achieve their objective goal there, but they end up unifying a people. And not only that, it makes them hate you, the imposer of the sanctions, more so than the intended aim. You're trying to get them to hate their own government, but they see you as the one that is preventing them from access to the urgent, critical care they need, critical medication they need. It's causing hyperinflation, and basic commodities are shooting through the roof, and they see Washington as the culprit, not their own government.
Right. This is happening, in many countries that, are targeted by the United States with this form of economic warfare. And it's, 39 countries, or a third of the world's population, that's being targeted. And the Pentagon and the think tanks in Washington, D.C. know that these economic measures are not having the desired effect, that they're trying to achieve. And it's interesting that in the Biden report on how they're going to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, one of the sections talks about the need to review what these economic measures, the impact that they're having on other countries, and whether they are, they say, unduly hindering the country's ability to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, that unduly hindering gives the administration lots of wiggle room to say that they're not too much of a burden, but we know the reality is that this is a time when nations around the world are coming together to collaborate and try to deal with this pandemic. And the United States, unfortunately, is not participating in that in a way that's really cooperative and is imposing harsher measures on countries like Iran.
Thank you both, and do stay safe. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Margaret Flowers there, from a co-director at PopularResistance.org, joining us out of Baltimore, Maryland, and Dr. Wilmer Leone, columnist and political scientist, joining us out of Washington, D.C. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iran's permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna has slammed Israel for assassinating his country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, at a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. Kazem Gharibabadi said clear evidence suggests Israel masterminded Fakhrizadeh's assassination. He said Tel Aviv must be held accountable for the murder, calling on the IAEA and its members to strongly condemn the, quote, inhumane crime. The envoy said Iran will not leave such a heinous crime unanswered. Gharibabadi also emphasized Tehran's commitment to pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in late November when his car was ambushed near the Iranian capital, Tehran. The Yemeni army says its drones have successfully hit major targets at King Khalid Air Base in Saudi Arabia's Asir province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the two Samad 3 drones were used in the operation. Sari said the attacks were in response to Saudi Arabia's continued aggression and blockade against the Yemeni people. King Khalid Air Base and other military targets in the south of the Arab Kingdom have been repeatedly hit by Yemeni drones in recent days. On Thursday, the Yemeni army also launched a missile attack on an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah. At least 20 people have been killed and 30 others wounded in a terrorist attack that rocked the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The incident occurred when an explosive-laden car was detonated at a popular restaurant. The attack was claimed by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terrorist group. The Somali capital is regularly targeted with attacks by the terrorist group. Al-Shabaab has long been waging a deadly insurgency seeking to unseat the internationally backed government in Mogadishu. The militants were driven out of the capital in 2011 but still control swathes of territory in Somalia. Let's bring Abiyomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of Pan-African Newswire in for this story for more on insights on that. Abiyomi, welcome. So another attack in the Somalia, dozens killed. Is there more the governments can do to prevent this?
It's a very difficult situation because the government itself is divided. There was, of course, disagreements over the structuring of a national election. So the government itself is extremely fragile. You also have a lot of dependency upon the United States and upon the European Union for training and financing of AMISOM, the African Union mission in Somalia, which really is the bulwark of the security apparatus in Somalia. This goes back decades. It has a lot to do with the U.S. intervention in Somalia, going all the way back to the 1970s. So this is a continuation of the type of destabilization programs that have been instituted in various African countries. And Somalia, of course, is a case in point because it is strategically located and is also has oil resources as well.
Okay, Abiyomi, thank you very much indeed for your contribution there and insights. Abiyomi Azikiwe is the editor at the Pan-African Newswire, joining us out of Detroit. Now, Nigeria has launched the vaccination of its citizens against the deadly COVID-19 disease, and only frontline health workers at the moment are getting the jab. Danjuma Abdullahi has more from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
Has described the commencement of this vaccination exercise of Nigerians as a historic moment in the fight against the COVID-19. The kickoff of the vaccination followed the delivery of close to 4 million doses of the COVAX AstraZeneca vaccines to Nigeria on 2nd March 2021. Nigerian health officials said the delay in the start of the vaccination was to ensure that the vaccines were checked for safety.
The vaccines that we're going to be delivering today to Nigerians are safe, they're effective, and we're going to roll out this vaccine in a very efficient manner, just like we all work together as one country and defeated the world polio viruses. Today, it feels proud to be a Nigerian. All of you should be proud.
The Nigerian government said Nigerians should support the planned and systematic rollout of the vaccines and mobilize citizens for the vaccination exercise. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, played an important role in the arrival of the vaccines and says the successful battle against the COVID-19 will impact positively on routine immunization of Nigerian children against the other preventable childhood killer diseases.
UNICEF was the organization that did the procurement and the delivery of those vaccines on the 2nd of March, and we're very, very pleased that today we're able to administer them. But also now the challenge is getting them to the states, and the states starting to vaccinate the health, the frontline workers, the health workers, so that they can be protected as quickly as is possible.
This medical doctor becomes the first Nigerian at this occasion to be given the COVID-19 vaccination. He has been a frontline health worker since March 2020 and has lost his father to the COVID-19. 158,000 Nigerians have so far been infected with the COVID-19, and over 1,900 have died of the disease. The World Health Organization has stated that the vaccines have undergone rigorous regulatory processes at global and country level and have been certified safe and effective. The next challenge for Nigerian health officials is how to reach millions of Nigerians in remote rural communities. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Meanwhile, Brazil has recorded nearly 75,500 new cases of COVID-19 infection. That's the country's highest daily tally since July. Authorities say 1,800 people also died of the disease on Friday after two straight days of record death tolls of over 1,900. Brazil has lost over a quarter of a million lives to the virus so far. That's the second worst record of COVID-19 fatalities after the US toll. Meanwhile, the government's crisis response team has warned that daily deaths could hit 3,000 if serious action is not taken to control the pandemic. But President Jair Bolsonaro remains reluctant, telling Brazilians to stop, quote, the whining. Several European countries have reported more coronavirus infections and deaths as the continent remains in the grip of the pandemic. Italy recorded over 24,000 new daily infections and nearly 300 deaths. The country's total cases now stand at over 3 million, with more than 99,000 deaths. Britain also reported 236 new deaths, bringing its total fatalities to over 124,000. The country has so far confirmed more than 4.2 million cases. In France, the death toll rose by more than 439, while the number of infections grew by over 23,000. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech Republic, the government there has announced that it might begin to transfer COVID patients abroad, as the situation in hospitals at home has reached a critical point. The country now has the highest rate of new cases per capita in the world. Anti-monarchy activists in Catalonia have held a demonstration to protest the visit by King Philippe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. The royal visit comes weeks after the region was rocked by violent riots following the imprisonment of a musician for tweets and lyrics against the monarchy. Jose Kadri has more in this report.
Monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest a visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurrent theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years. Here are some of the grievances with regard to this particular visit to the car factory.
The King of Spain will never be welcome in Catalonia. The King of the October 3rd speech, the King who 3.5 years ago called business owners to urge them to relocate their headquarters out of Catalonia, is not welcome.
The Spanish government Thursday announced it will dedicate part of the Coronavirus European Recovery Fund to launch an electric car battery plant with SEAT's parent company, Volkswagen. But trade unions say the transition towards a greener economy requires transparent labor reforms and should not overlook basic rights.
We need to know how the European Recovery Fund is going to be spent. We believe it should be entirely put under public administration. The investments in the car industry should be in compliance with public interest first, and that includes taking into account the reduction of the average working hours in view of the increasing automation.
The automotive industry in Spain generates nearly 2 million direct and indirect jobs. It represents 10% of the GDP and 19% of total exports. Declining sales and extended shutdowns due to the coronavirus pandemic have forced Japanese car maker Nissan last year to shut down one of its three plants in Catalonia. Kasai Kadri, Barcelona.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Climate change thus becomes an intangible phenomenon that affects the planet rather than a tangible emergency that harms individuals. This obscures the very real impacts of climate change on people's lives. Flooded homes and neighborhoods, extreme heat and cold endured by the most vulnerable, and a lack of protection in the face of biodiversity loss, says John Herrera, writer, in an article published under the heading Capital versus Biosphere. Humankind is testing the limits of the very space in which we live. Here's more. Temperatures continue to break records. The meager results of international climate action reveal a disconnect between most of the world's governments and science. The COVID-19 crisis is evidence that collapse on a global scale is possible. It has become clear that we are intricately connected at a global level beyond the limits of our immediate commitments and countries. The COVID-19 crisis could see the climate agenda pushed even further to the margins. The unprecedented measures taken over the past year have been justified by arguments that they are necessary to respond to a real emergency, such as the pandemic. These arguments distinguish between what is deemed as an emergency, stopping the spread of the virus, and what is deemed as an ominous forewarning, the environmental crisis. Climate change thus becomes an intangible phenomena that affects the planet rather than a tangible emergency that harms individuals. This obscures the very real impacts of climate change on people's lives. Flooded homes and neighborhoods, extreme heat and cold endured by the most vulnerable, and a lack of protection in the face of biodiversity loss. Moreover, climate change and species loss is closely linked with the context in which pandemics flourish, therefore, the vulnerability of humankind. The pandemic has brought about an irreversible change of outlook. For decades, resources allocation has been oriented towards increasing market efficiency. Basic rights such as healthcare have been commodified. Competitiveness has taken precedence over cooperation. In a world where collapse is possible, prevention must be front and center when it comes to devising and implementing public policies aimed at combating climate change and building resilience. Rocked individualism will no longer wash. The push to ensure that public interest, the decommodification of fundamental rights and cooperation prevail demands a new eco-social agenda that aims to be hegemonic. This agenda should focus on three key aspects: biodiversity, the local, and energy transition. In a post-COVID world, policy that protects and promotes biodiversity must become a priority. The ongoing mass destruction of species has until now been low down governments' agendas. Today, biodiversity loss and health can be clearly linked. As part of this planet, humanity's greatest guarantee of survival is the preservation of ecosystem services which provide essential benefits for human health. To give one example, a debate in Barcelona in recent years has centered around the possible expansion of the airport and its impact on nearby protected areas, in particular the Llobregat Delta. The expansion threatened to affect a reservoir of biodiversity in this area and completely overlook the importance of nearby agricultural land. Today, the best strategy for any metropolitan area is to have spaces dedicated to the protection of biodiversity and farmland to encourage local production. And this leads us to the second vital component of a new eco-social agenda, the local. This can be broken down into two fundamental aspects. The first involves the care economy, and increasing the value, both in social and economic terms, attached to everyday labor of caring for others, which is so often carried out by women. The pandemic has laid bare how care work, often poorly paid or simply unpaid, forms the foundations of life. Recognizing the value of this work and reassessing salaries to acknowledge what market logic is yet to comprehend is a key part of an eco-social strategy. The second aspect relates to localized supply and value chains. The health crisis has exposed the vulnerability of societies dependent on goods that, despite being relatively simple to produce, are only manufactured thousands of miles away. The fact that face masks had to be shipped to Europe from China highlights the fragility of current models of production and consumption. The trend that began in 1980s in countries such as the United Kingdom of phasing out domestic agriculture to replace it with cheaper products grown elsewhere ceases to make sense. Globalized, hyper-connected economies have feet of clay. This crisis has evidenced the need for a rethink. Spain's service industry will suffer enormously in a world in which tourism holds less weight, and the country must be able to counteract this dependency by tilting its economy towards more local production chains that can internalize the cost of transportation goods. The third pillar of eco-social agenda is energy, not only because energy is a way to tackle the challenge of climate change, but because it is a starting point from which to rethink the production model. Throughout history, energy has been a means to gain power and control. Today, there is no reason why control over energy sources should remain in the hands of a few corporations instead of being more widely distributed. Moving towards a new energy model would reduce Spain's energy dependence, which at 74% stands well above the EU average, about 60%. In Catalonia, the figure reaches 90% due to the low penetration of renewable energies. Today, unlike after the 2008 financial crisis, the cheapest energy by far comes from renewable sources. In the case of solar power, prices have dropped drastically in recent years. A new energy model based on decarbonization could also help redistribute wealth and create a production and industrial framework with savings, efficiency, renewable generation, and demand management. The expansion of renewable energy should be carried out in a progressive way, with generation models that reward investments made by local energy communities. At a time when the service industry is at risk of regressing dramatically, the energy agenda can be part of a move towards the reindustrialization of European countries. However, we must be aware of the limitations posed by the scarcity of the rare minerals needed to manufacture these technologies, as well as the limits to growth on a finite planet. There can be no technocratic illusion. The social model must change, and sustainability will not be achieved without political friction. A new energy model alone is not enough, though it would represent a significant breakthrough. Every global challenge requires a degree of global governance, and there is much work to be done in this respect. Under the Trump administration, the US was out of the picture, resulting in a lack of global leadership. Meanwhile, the EU has failed to make an appearance. Despite a gloomy outlook, the emergence of regional and continental leaders capable of establishing a more definitive agenda is of prime importance. Tackling climate change will necessarily involve acting not alone, but with others. The way out is collective, that is to say political. The environmental transition will filter through the entire social structure, from the collective imagination to legislation, through every budget of different administrations. This century will be the century of climate change, where all conflicts will center on the conflict between capital and biosphere. The question is no longer whether this will alter the foundations upon which policies and politics have been built, but when. The impacts of climate change will be felt widely and deeply, exacerbating tensions across a broad range of issues, from migration to wealth distribution to gender inequalities.
Food for thought.
Hello, everybody, and here we present you words worth pondering upon from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. Peace be upon him. Faith stands on four supports. They are dependence upon God, entrustment with God, submission to the decision of God, and satisfaction with the acts of God. This belief stands on four supports. They are the desire for the worldly pleasures, fear from missing any worldly pleasure, anger, and passion.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a particularly warm welcome to our regular listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, who's been giving us wonderful insights on various aspects of this great man's life, and of course, it's a program dedicated to his memory. And may God bless his great soul. And Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, salam and welcome to the program, first of all.
Alaykum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we're talking about economic pressure on Iran.
Yes.
And how the Imam, may God bless his great soul, dealt with that.
Yes. How do you think he dealt with
it? I think he dealt with it beautifully by saying that, you know, we'll create a great wall around Iran and let us grow our own food.
if that's the correct
quotation.
He actually
said, if they wall us.
If they wall us.
If they put a big wall, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Allah will send his rain, we will grow our own fruit.
Allah will send his rain and grow it. I mean, this is wonderful. It comes right out of the Quranic text. I mean, he's taken me back to several very important stories in the Quran where, you know, Allah is the risk giver, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is where we as Muslims, you know, sometimes
are
we
weak.
Wonder.
Are weak.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have enough trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And yet he is the one. There's a wonderful passage somewhere where Prophet Abraham says to his followers, I don't mean to digress, but we're basically talking about, he says, he is the one who created me. When I was sick, he gave me health. When I was hungry, he fed me. You know, there's some verses like this, which I know I went through. And they're beautiful in terms of who it is that really raises you and who is the one who really sustains you. And, of course, that's what we shouldn't lose sight of. And this is what the Imam points out over and over again, because he's his beloved. Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, loves Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
یه ملتی که شهادت را می طلبند و دعا می خوان برای شهادت اینها از دخالت نظامی می ترسند.
Does a nation that seeks martyrdom and even prays for martyrdom fear military intervention? Does it fear an economic blockade? If the whole world closes the doors of their countries to us, a country with a population of about 30 million, if they build a wall around Iran and imprison us here in Iran, we prefer it over having our doors open so that plunderers invade our country.
ما میخوایم چه بکنیم که به این تمدنی که از توحش بدتر است، این تمدنی که حیوانات بیابان.
What are we to do with this civilization which is worse than beasts, a civilization which the behavior of desert animals are better than it? Why would we ever need this civilization? This gate of civilization which the deposed Shah wanted to open to us means world powers should have full control over us and may take away all our possessions and then send us a couple of puppets. It means that they may take our oil and build a base for themselves. We need this great civilization for what? Is this civilization?
ما این تمدن بزرگ را می‌خوام چی بکنیم؟ این تمدن این پدر و پسر و خصوصا این پسر کشور ما را به عقب راند و همه چیز ما را به باد داد.
This father and son, and particularly this son, brought backwardness to our country and ruined everything, such that if even now all our nation joined their hands, as they have alhamdulillah done so, and intend to repair the damages that have been done to us in these 50 odd years, as well as the damages done to our country by America 20 odd years ago, it would take us many years to repair them.
ما میخوام چه کنیم روابط داشته باشیم با اونهایی که میخوان ما را بشاپن.
Why should we have ties with those who want to loot us? Is our relationship with them anything but that of a plunderer and one who is being plundered? Why should we need this? Let them close all the doors on us and impose an economic blockade on us. We ourselves have a vast country. We have water. Allah gives us rain. We ourselves will sow and eat from our own crops. We have no need of these issues. They must not try to frighten a nation which wants to give its life so that its independence is preserved. This independence and freedom that we have achieved is a heavenly gift. It is a divine gift which has come to us, and we are obliged to preserve it. If we do not preserve this, we have been ungrateful of Allah's blessing. We must preserve this blessing. We are not afraid of these threats that they make by bringing their naval vessels to the Persian Gulf and elsewhere and here and there, these are a thing of the past. Before, yes. In the past, it was such that when they wanted to impose a treaty, someone would let out a groan and, for example, a vessel would enter the Persian Gulf and the issue was settled.
So, yeah, your take on that, please, Dr.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Well, you know, I think that quote that we heard, I mean, says it all. There's really not much more we can add to that.
Sure.
He's basically saying that, you know, they always threaten you with economic pressure, sanctions.
That's right, yes.
And he said, you know, a people who pray for martyrdom, who, you know, are connected to Allah, they don't, this stuff doesn't scare them.
It doesn't, no.
Military threats don't scare them, economic
Sanctions don't scare them,
whatever. Yes. Mm. And unfortunately, this is the problem we have today, is that some Muslims, whether, you know, in generally in the Ummah or whether it's in Iran, they don't really believe Allah's promises.
Mm.
They're not certain that Allah will help you.
Mm.
They say, yeah, okay, that's what it says in the Quran, and I believe it every now and then, and maybe, but maybe also we need to, you know, try to be good with Tawgut. And, you know, this is the beauty when we talked about, you know, in a revolution and in this great movement, having a great leader like Imam and showing us the way. Because obviously those people who have power and wealth, they will do anything to maintain their wealth and power.
Exactly.
And once they see things like military threats or coup d'etat attempts or the invasion of Saddam, eight-year war, whatever, it doesn't reach its goal, they will go towards the economic side of things.
Sure.
And as the Supreme Leader has said so many times, their main focus today is economics.
Yes.
And this is why we have the resistance economy that was mentioned by the Supreme Leader, which is, it doesn't mean a sort of, you know, bare bones economy. It means an economy that is able to resist these political pressures.
Pressures, exactly.
And this has to do with our internal capabilities and in our internal power.
Exactly.
If we are able to have a strong
self-reliant economy
domestically, then this will, you know, in many ways and as a multiplier, be able to resist those pressures that come from the outside.
Exactly.
And the bottom line is this, in the case of Iran. As long as the model for Iranian economy is selling oil to import stuff, whether that stuff is from Europe or America
or elsewhere,
or Russia or China or India or wherever, we're going to have problems.
Yes.
So we have to change that equation, which is, you know, sell the oil, the raw oil, the crude oil, for cash, and then use that cash to buy our stuff, which is basically what the, you know, the gentlemen in the south of the, in the Persian Gulf area do. This is their model of living.
Right. Yes.
And believe me, it's more than just economics. It's a way of life. It's a lifestyle, as they say.
Yes.
And this is where you see, and this is connected to when you see the Supreme Leader talking about Islamic lifestyle and Islamic civilization. A Muslim, an Islamic society, has to be self-reliant, has to earn its income through work and through the power of its mind and the ability to innovate and to produce and to make things that are of benefit to humanity. And what we see with oil, unfortunately, oil is a good thing. I'm not against oil. Nobody's against oil.
No.
But what we see with oil as a reality of the matter is that you have the oil industry in Iran, which creates a lot of the income for the nation, and yet it's less than 2% of the population that's employed by it. It's in the nature of the thing. Okay. A nation that has mass employment and good jobs, you know, it's not going to happen just with the oil industry. Okay, assuming we have a doubling or tripling of this industry, if we're going to say that there's a concomitant amount of employment rise, which never happens, but let's just say theoretically, you would have 4% of the population in the oil industry. Well, you know, that's not enough.
No.
So we can't rely on the oil industry. And also, we can't rely on crude oil. We have to process it.
Yeah, you have to diversify your economy.
Processing it means you're value adding. It means you're creating you know, refineries, which are more jobs, which are more proper real jobs.
Jobs.
I say that as somebody, one of my grandfathers, his job was in the refinery.
Sure.
For 34 years. So I know, you know, I know what that means. And it was a proper job. It was a good job. It was well paying. It helped him support his family and, you know, whatever. A large family. It's a proper real industrial job. You remember those?
Sure.
You're an engineer?
Well, yes, we had them.
Remember?
Yes, and they're gone.
Right.
Now we've got a service economy, which doesn't mean anything.
Right. Starbucks.
Starbucks. Latte. And, you know, propping up private banks, right. Which take away your money anyway.
Right.
So.
Right. So the point
savings.
Exactly.
I'm bankrupt. And I make an appeal, actually, on this radio. That if there are any donations, please send them my way.
So you see what I'm saying? So in the best case...
Because of the austerity crisis. Right. Anyway.
In the best case, an oil industry, you turn it into an oil refining industry. Oil refining industry.
Yes, that's right. You've got to diversify.
So
you've got to
make products, which is petroleum products, everything from, you know, naphtha...
Plastics to tarp, bitumen for roads, for example,
exactly.
Asphalt,
all the things that, you know, everybody knows. Petrochemicals.
Sure.
And so on and so forth. You know, gasoline.
Yes.
Instead of, you know, importing gasoline, hey, why don't you export
it? Why don't you export it?
And the interesting thing is this. Let me just tell you a little story.
Please.
Which is that, you know, for all these years during the various governments, for whatever reasons, which we're not going to get into now, but by the tone of my voice, you can tell what
I
mean.
Yes, exactly. I know where you're going with
this. The gentleman decided not to increase gasoline production in Iran. Mm. Very strange thing.
Yes.
One of the major oil exporters of the world. Mm. You know, top three, top four.
Four, and it's not exporting
gasoline. And it's not making gasoline. Mm. And it's importing all its gasoline. You remember those cries?
Yes.
You know, a couple of years back, we're going to, you know, sanction Iranian gasoline. We're going to shut down Iran. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Yes, I remember this.
You recall this?
Yes.
Well, what did the government do within 6 months?
They produced more gasoline, didn't they?
Well, first, they rationed.
They rationed it.
Right.
So they could save it.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's number one.
Number one.
Then what did they do? They started making gasoline.
Making gasoline, yes.
So within 6 months, a new oil minister comes in, Mr. Mirkazemi, right? Former Revolutionary Guard.
Sure.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, you know they're going to sanction him, right?
Mm. Well, he's individually sanctioned, isn't he?
I don't know.
I don't.
The point I'm trying to make is
maybe he's not allowed to go to the toilet.
I don't know. The point is, within 6 months, we're
producing.
We're not importing gasoline anymore.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Okay. Mm. So whatever, the 30 years before?
Yes. You were importing it.
Right. 6 months?
6 months, you don't need to.
And nobody's talking about sanctioning Iran with gasoline anymore. Yes. I mean, I don't hear it. Have you heard it?
No, I've not heard it recently. Right? No.
Great example. Perfect example right there. Okay? Mm. So what Imam is telling us, way back then. Remember?
Yes.
This is the beginning.
This is the beginning when there's nothing there.
Like the first year of the revolution. This is not like some... thing that he has come to the conclusion after 35 years. He's saying at that time, when our economy was completely dependent
on the outside world,
as it had been for 100 plus years.
Yes, yes.
At that time, he's saying, who wants this kind of life and society? He says it's worse than animals to be dependent on these people.
Yes.
Okay. This is the beauty of Imam. Imam says things, he is the most clear about the matter, and he was the person that showed us the final
end result
right there from
the beginning,
and it was all, as you mentioned, Quranic.
Quranic.
It was all from the Quran.
Yes.
Okay. And why do we say this is important? Because explaining this is key. We claim that the Quran is reality. The Quran is telling us
absolutely of
real cause and effect.
A real cause and effect. Yes.
Okay? Quran is not like a story. It's not like some nice recitation.
Unfortunately...
Do you understand what I'm saying?
There's a point here.
It's a manual.
It's a manual. But the point is, this is the truth of the Quran itself. The Quran itself says that those who study this book or look at this book, for many, for the vast majority, it's a collection of stories. But for those of us who are given insight and wisdom into the book by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, they see lessons in this. Right. They see reality in it. And this is the difference. Unfortunately, most Muslims are like this.
that they just take the superficial end of the Quran and they just think that it's just a collection of stories.
Right.
And it doesn't have any relevance or any bearing on the reality of, you know, running a state, for example. Right?
Exactly. And the point is, and the Supreme Leader talks about this as well.
Sure.
And he puts it this way. He says, you either believe and rely on Nusrat-e-Ilahi,
on
the help of God, on the support of God,
sure,
or you believe and rely on something else.
Exactly.
It's either this or that.
It's either this or that,
right?
Yeah.
Now, and the point is, look, for somebody who's not religious, who doesn't believe in God, whatever.
Mm.
All this stuff that we're saying doesn't have any relevance. We're talking to people who have in their heart and in their life are claiming and showing that they believe in God.
Mm.
Correct?
Correct.
This is what we're assuming.
Exactly.
That when you say that you believe in God, you really do.
Do.
That, you know, when you pray and when you fast and when you're doing those things that you do, that you're doing this because you believe in God and God's power and God's presence in your life and all that. And then suddenly, when it comes to these pressures, suddenly you start doubting.
Mm.
This is what we're talking about.
I know.
Okay? And again, I'm addressing myself first. I'm not claiming to be better than,
anyone. Sure, absolutely.
I'm simply saying that. Mm. Do you really believe in God's promise? This is what you have to ask yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Mm. This is what you have to ask yourself.
Mm. Do you really believe in God's promise?
Okay?
Mm.
This is the point. God says that he is, and the Supreme Leader again mentioned this. He said there is ayah in the Quran. He says that it is incumbent on us. The victory of the moment is incumbent on us. If the moment follows what we say, and
exactly,
Allah is saying it's incumbent on me.
It's incumbent on me to give you victory. Whatever shape or form
he's doing taklif for himself.
Taklif for himself.
It's wajib for me to give you.
Sure.
If you do these things, it's wajib for me.
Me.
SubhanAllah.
Mm.
Right?
Wonderful.
So why are you scared?
Mm.
Why are you worried if somebody, you know, threatens you with this or that?
That's where you get those wonderful metaphors in the Quran where God says, it wasn't you who threw the arrow, it was I. It wasn't you who threw the stone, it was I who threw the stone.
Exactly. So the point is simply that, you know, when Imam talks about these things, or when he talked about these things so many years ago, he hit the nail on
the head.
You know, yes, it was bullseye.
Sorry, I keep coming back to that head part again.
Right?
You're
it's
right.
Bullseye.
It's a bullseye.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Way back then. None of this, you know, fancy schmancy economic stuff.
Yeah, homework stuff that we're all this
right?
analysis.
GDP, PPP, whatever, none of that
doing
stuff.
Doing on a power computer laptop
right?
to see exactly what it is.
Very clearly, Quranically said, listen, the country that is dependent on others is Zalil.
Is Zalil. It's enslavement.
Exactly. And We can't accept this.
No.
We would rather be walled in and not be disconnected from the rest of the world and grow our own food and eat it ourselves than to be part of this scheme.
Sure.
Again, what's the scheme? The scheme is you give us our oil, you give us your oil for cheap, we will give you whatever stuff you want.
Mm.
There is no dignity in this.
Exactly.
There is no dignity in this.
No.
There is no dignity in this.
Mm.
Don't be fooled by the expensive cars and the Burj Al Falah,
well,
you know.
This is
in Dubai and in Doha you know, with the, you know, the branch of University of so-and-so and, you know, the branches of the Louvre. And this is all
nonsense.
It's all nonsense.
Because the point is this.
Okay.
And, I mean, I don't need to say this.
There's no dignity in this.
You can't buy
dignity.
Exactly.
From Kafir.
Kafir.
You can't buy civilization from anyone.
Anyone. I mean, the thing is that what I want to point out is that, you know, I don't mean to preach to somebody who's from, you know, from LSE, you know. I mean, this is the thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, you tell me, because,
yes.
I mean, I am a layman as far as these things are concerned.
But you are an engineer.
Of course.
Yes.
But the thing is that, to me, it's all one-sided. That it's a one-way street.
Exactly. It's logic. I mean,
this is logical.
You don't have to be.
It's a one-way street. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to see this.
You don't have to be.
But it's a one-way street. I mean, the moment the oil finishes or the gas finishes in, for example, UAE, that's the end of the story, isn't
it? It's only Abu Dhabi that has the oil.
Yeah, whatever.
You saw what happened to Dubai when the financial crisis happened.
It
all blew up.
And he went back and
said, "Cousin, give me a little cash."
A little bit.
He said, "You know what? I'll give you the cash. Just change the name of the tower." It's no longer Burj al Arab. It's Burj al Khalifa.
Burj al Khalifa.
Right?
My God.
Because anyway, I bailed you out.
Staggering economics. But anyway, carry on, sir. Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that when these resources are gone, and they're finite, they're limited, once they're gone...
It's about your dignity as a human being.
Being.
It's not about how much, you know, chickens you can stuff in your belly. Okay?
Not true.
Okay,
nice
there's it's called marginal utility. You know, after
marginal utility. It's, lovely.
After the
I'm
sixth,
being educated
after the sixth
program,
chicken
yes.
that you stuff in your belly, but you don't really want anymore.
No,
right? There's right. a limit.
There's a limit to that. Of course, there is.
You understand?
Absolutely.
And it goes down. The more you eat, the less it becomes for most of us.
More most of us.
there are some who can't eat enough. Right?
They can't eat enough.
They can't get enough. Right?
Yeah, that's a different story.
Okay.
Yes.
So
unless you happen to be Abdul bin Aziz or something like that, in which all the chickens and sheep are consumed.
Right. Where there's a camel, in which there's a sheep. In which
there's a chicken as well.
And I don't know. I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah, you tell me. Right?
I haven't seen that.
Right? There's a camel, in which there's a goat, in which there's a sheep. In which there's a, you know,
couple of stuffed chickens right. or something. Yeah. Fine. Sure.
That's how they eat.
Yeah.
That's how they eat.
Yeah.
You know, what can I say? Eat. I wouldn't even call that eating.
I wouldn't even call it that. Right. I mean, it
I
has a whole new
that.
Meaning to the Kalapachi or something. I don't know. I haven't a clue. Anyway, carry on, sir, on this. But you're right, because we don't develop the infrastructure. We don't develop... I mean, the imam is not only talking...
It's not only the material thing. It's who you become as a human being when you do this.
Being, exactly, in terms of the dignity of your mission.
It's about who you become as somebody who is using those blessings, those ni'mat. Mm. And he says it in the quote, I don't know if... You know, that we got to that part where he talks about, you know, you're doing kufr ni'mat.
Yes.
You're not dealing with you're not using the blessings that Allah has given you.
Exactly.
You know,
you're misusing them actually.
Right. And so when that happens, guess what happens? Guess what Allah does then?
Mm.
What does He do? He takes away the blessings.
Of course He does, and He leaves you to yourself.
He says, "You I gave you the blessing. You do it.
Go ahead.
You know better than me.
Okay. Go ahead.
Please.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see how far you get."
It's up to you.
And then He reminds you very nicely in many surahs in the Quran how many a nation has destroyed itself by
right.
you know,
I just want to add
by
a little
distancing itself.
I want to add
Allah
a little example here of
yeah,
this
please,
example. Just
please.
It's a little bit you know in parentheses, but there, I was reading recently a lot of rivayat. It said that if somebody goes after marrying a woman because of her money, then Allah will leave you to her and her money.
Very nicely.
He says maybe I wanted to give you more money.
Huh? Maybe I wanted to give you more money. But no,
you didn't go after iman. You didn't go marry somebody because of their iman
or piety or whatever. You
right.
went for
you,
that.
You went for the money. So it's you and that money.
But it's very nice because, as
and
you say, it's
a,
cause and effect. It's
and then,
the principle of the
and
thing.
And then there's another event. It says you will always be zalim.
You'll not have any dignity or respect.
The money that your wife or her family has to give.
Exactly.
Okay. So it's very similar concept.
It is.
Okay. Mm. You want to be dependent on kufar? Go ahead. Be dependent on them.
Sure.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
See what... Or you want to be dependent on me.
Exactly.
Now, this is... Again, if somebody is not religious, somebody doesn't care about God, doesn't even believe in God, whatever. We're not even dealing with you because you don't get it, what we're talking about, right?
Exactly.
We're talking to people who claim...
Who claim.
Who say, we believe in God.
God.
Well, this is where it shows itself. This is where it shows itself.
Mm. So how about a little faith?
Right. And not all this crazy talk about, you know, if we just do this, if we just do that, if they just smile at us, if we just wink at them, you know, if we just, you know, rub a little elbows and if we just, you know, deal with this or if you give us a little bit of that, we'll give you a little bit of this. I'm not questioning normal interstate affairs, normal international relations between two states and two governments. This is normal affairs. You talk to everyone... You know, you...
No, that's an entire... Diplomacy is an entirely
right.
different
Diplomacy
field.
Is diplomacy. It has its place.
It has its
always,
place.
It's always there. Hmm. The point is not to rely... As a Muslim...
As a Muslim.
Don't rely...
In principle.
Don't rely on kafir. Don't rely on your rizq coming from, you know, appeasing the kafir.
Well, the point is this, my friend. The thing is that when we look at the life of the... This is why the life of the Prophet... We have to go back to that. When we look at the life of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, did he do that? I mean, all the kafirs of his time were saying to him, look,
we'll give you everything.
We'll give you everything. we'll give you whatever you want. The most beautiful woman, we'll give you that. You want power and position, we'll give you that. You want to be chief of everything, we'll give you that. We'll give you Makkah even. We'll give you the whole lot.
We'll give you all the money.
But just stop saying what you're saying. Just stop what you're doing, okay? And what did he say?